Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Submariner Sinclair, a thrilling World War II military adventure story, by John Wingate, narrated by Nigel Patterson. Chapter 1. First Command, The Narrow Seas.
Let go!
As the little ship swung to her anchor in the tideway 1 mile off Ramsgate, the young captain glanced at his watch. Just in time for a quick supper before the convoy comes round North Foreland from Southend, he thought. Wearily, he unslung his binoculars and hitched them over the brass voice pipe. He clattered down the steel ladder, but halted on the middle rung. "Looks nice enough, but it's all too quiet," he mused, as his eyes scanned the peaceful scene. Half a mile to the northeast, the massive cliffs rose from the grey deep. The first fingers of the setting sun stole across the sea, and the rose-tinted cliffs were reflected on the placid surface of the water. Only the gentle hiss of the tide, as it raced across the swinging anchor cable, betrayed the danger of these treacherous waters. Peter Sinclair, sub-lieutenant, Royal Navy, commanding officer of Chaser 25, continued to enjoy the peace of the evening. He turned his head to the east, once again noting the ship's position. He was anchored in the Downs, off the quicksands of the Goodwins, now known as the Graveyard. Some 2 dozen rusty sticks jutted out of the sea, and Peter instinctively counted them again. 24, he muttered. They were the masts of the wrecks now littering these dangerous waters, wrecks of the obstinate colliers and merchant ships sunk by the enemy only 19 miles distant. Shelled by the gunfire from German gun emplacements on Cap Grinet, torpedoed by lurking E-boats, blasted by mines, and caught by the shifting sands, these grim reminders poked their rust-scarred masts skywards. But undaunted, the convoys kept on coming, one westerly from Southend to Portsmouth, and one easterly. Once a week, undeterred by the enemy's fury, they still passed through the narrow seas, for coal and food were the lifeblood of the island. These sad, skeleton-like masts emphasized the sacrifice which the merchant sailors were making. "Blast the Germans," Peter growled, as he walked aft to the wardroom. He reached the hatch and turned to give one last look to the northeastward, but the convoy was not yet in sight. He was descending the ladder when he heard the spluttering of an aircraft. Peter turned his head, and his grey eyes took in the outline of a single-seater fighter that swept 300 feet above him. The Spitfire crackled, coughed, and gusts of black smoke belched from its engine, and he heard the whine of the wind as it hissed along the shapely wings. "She'll never clear the cliffs," Peter thought, as he stood mesmerized by the tragedy of the returning fighter. She hit the sea half a mile away, in a large plume of spray. Sickened by the sight, Peter began to turn away, but at that moment his heart leapt as a tiny white mushroom floated like thistledown above the subsiding foam to billow gently upon the sea.
"He's bailed out!" Peter yelled. "Action stations, number one!"
The tousled head of Peter's first lieutenant appeared through the wardroom hatch.
"Aye, aye, sir,"
shouted sub-lieutenant James MacDonald, as he rushed forward to call the hands from the mess decks.
"Action stations! Action stations!"
The seamen poured out from below, and the little ship gathered speed and was soon alongside the crumpled silk parachute, which had now become sodden in the water. The pilot lay on his back, his yellow May West a bright spot of colour.
"Well, that's your dinkum of your cobbers,"
a broad Australian voice twanged from the water as a tanned face grinned up at them. 2 seamen went over the side and hauled him to the scrambling net, and then the pilot slipped from his harness whilst helping hands bundled him over the guardrails.
"Come and have supper," Peter greeted him. "Thanks, cobber, I will."
Pools of water flooded the coconut matting on the deck, as the dripping man padded forward to Peter's cabin below the bridge. The cook handed him a mug of hot tea as he went by the galley.
"Thanks a lot, chum."
"This all right, sir,"
the burly cook grinned.
"Plenty more where that came from."
After a hot meal, Peter and Jamie MacDonald took their temporary guest on deck. The sun was sinking below the horizon, and from Ramsgate's breakwater a white bow wave grew larger every moment.
"Bit late, that rescue launch," the pilot observed.
The launch was soon alongside, its throaty exhaust coughing and spluttering in the swell.
"So long," Peter said as he shook hands. "Good hunting."
"Thanks, and the same to you."
The eyes of the two young men met. Their two lives were to go different ways. Peter's to join up with the convoy now 3 miles distant and swinging down upon the tide. The pilot's to give his life over the New Guinea jungles and to win a posthumous Victoria Cross. The launch was soon lost to view, and already the green, red and white lights of the boys could be seen winking in the gathering dusk. 10 minutes later, the black outline of the first ship slid by Chaser 25. It was the leading destroyer, shepherding her flock through the intricate swept channel of the Downs. Silhouette after black silhouette lumbered after her, until Peter had counted 14. Close on either side, diminutive MLs fussed around their charges, hustling them into their two columns. They were now entering the dangerous area, for off the southwestern buoy, the German guns would inevitably start shelling from Cap Grenet. The shaded blue lights of signalling lanterns winked in the darkness, urging the ships to make all possible speed. Streamers of black smoke trailed from the squat funnels. The tide was under them as they slid past the black outline of Dover Castle. As tail-end Charlie, Chaser 25 was stationed at the rear of the convoy. Her duty was to keep the laggards closed up, and in the event of disaster, to pick up survivors.
"There she flashes," Peter murmured to Jamie, who was enjoying the night air on the bridge with his young captain.
It was futile to turn in until they were past the shelling area, and far better to be blown to bits in the open than caught below in a steel coffin. Sure enough, fine on the port bow of the convoy, the white light of the southwest Folkestone buoy winked its impatient warning as both young officers looked southwards towards the French coast, which was now invisible in the enveloping darkness. A vivid white light suddenly flickered along the southern horizon, and the young captain reached for his steel helmet, put it squarely on his head, and tapped its crown for luck. Methodically, he adjusted the strap so that it only reached the tip of his chin, for he had once seen a man's neck broken by the shock of the helmet flying back against the blast when the strap had been fastened beneath his chin. At the head of the convoy, an orange flame burst and a sharp crack reverberated against the cliffs as the first shells exploded on the water. Spouts of foam cascaded upwards, and golden plumes of spray showered gently downwards, lit by the fierce explosions of the next salvos. Peter tried to hide his eyes from the blinding flashes. The light dazzled him, so that he was blind for minutes afterwards.
"We're entering the area now," he said to the steel-helmeted lookouts, crouched by their Lewis guns in the wings of the bridge.
"So I can flip him, we'll see," the port lookout muttered to himself, and his teeth gleamed as he grinned in the darkness.
"Start counting 75, muttered Peter to his number one, as the French coast danced into light again. Both men glanced at their watches and waited with a sinking void in their stomachs.
72, 73, 74, Jamie counted.
An ear-splitting crack interrupted his counting, and bright orange flashes lit up the bridge. Peter's sharply drawn features turned towards the explosions, but his eyes were shut to prevent dazzling.
"All right, number one, pass the word. Normal shelling routine."
Jamie moved to the brass voice pipe and shouted down it,
"Normal shelling routine!"
And from the wheelhouse below them, the quartermaster repeated the order, his voice hollow and distant in the thick darkness. Jamie went to the drawer of the chart table and fumbled for the large whistle which he hung around his neck, as a long and distant rumbling, like midsummer thunder, reverberated along the French coast.
"There goes the sound of the guns."
"Strange, isn't it, after the arrival of the bricks?" said Jamie, half to himself.
Once again the French coast lit up as he glanced at his watch. Just over a minute later, he put the silver whistle to his lips, took an enormous breath, and a long whistle blast added its contribution to the cacophony.
"Down, all of you!" Peter shouted.
The men on the upper deck threw themselves flat, covering their heads with their arms. Seconds later, four spouts hurtled upwards, 200 yards from their port bow, and close to the dark mass of the last ship in the seaward column. A fierce blue light split wide the night, which became a crescendo of sound. The men in the chaser climbed to their feet again, but as suddenly the French coast flickered once more. Again the whistle blew. Peter was at the voice pipe adjusting his course, but he threw himself to the deck, and it was as well that he did so, for suddenly the night became as day in a holocaust of vivid flashes. Shells burst round them, 150 yards short and 3 over, in a perfect straddle. A peculiar fluttering whined through the air, and a sharp jar shook the little ship when the clang of metal upon metal rang from aft.
"We're hit, I think, Number One. Go and investigate."
But already Jamie had bounded down the ladder and was back within the minute.
"Only a splinter against one of the depth charges, sir. No damage."
"Better shooting than last week."
"Yes, they are improving. And so they should, the perishing swine."
"They get enough practice," muttered Peter as he moved to the voice pipe.
"Port 10.
The little ship swung to port, to follow the convoy, which had altered to its new course for Dungeness. Astern of the chaser, the southwest Folkestone buoy, now some 3 miles distant, still winked derisively, and it slowly dawned on them that the shelling had stopped. Now a lull of eerie silence replaced the infernal racket.
"Well, another CW convoy safely through, Number One."
"Yes, sir, and nobody hit."
They removed their tin hats. Peter wiped his forehead, already sore from the weight of the steel helmet.
"Better get some sleep, Number One. Send the hands to the cruising stations."
"Aye, aye, sir. Good night."
"Good night, Number One."
Peter settled down to the loneliness of the night's vigil. He still kept the night watches, because his first lieutenant was not yet experienced enough for them. The lookouts relaxed and started to sweep the horizon with their binoculars, their shadowy figures a blur in the wings of the bridge. To the eastward, the moon swung into the heavens, masked from the convoy by her gossamer veil of high cirrus. Night became as day, the pale luminosity spreading across the calm and glassy sea, grey and mysterious in its undulating serenity.
"A grand night. I should raise Dungeness light in an hour or so," Peter mused.
The wireless loudspeaker on the bridge crackled. Peter's head jerked to hear the message which was in code, but which he now knew by heart.
"From Athelstan. To all convoy CW-17. Suspicious vessels in sight, port bow. Am investigating."
"Oh, confound it. That's the end of a peaceful night. E-boats, I'll bet," Peter muttered as he moved to the voice pipe.
"Action stations!" he shouted down the voice pipe, and 30 seconds later men stumbled from their hammocks to rush half asleep to their quarters on deck. From the forecastle just below him, Peter watched a small group of men clearing away the 75 for action. The clanking securing chains dropped to the steel deck. The lean barrels swung to the port bow, the dangerous quarter. The steel tube shimmered in the pale moonlight. Up ahead of him, the two columns of the rugged little coasters and colliers stretched to the horizon, but in the darkness to the westward, the column leaders were invisible. The senior officer of the escort, in the Hunt-class destroyer, was out of sight. Waiting was a cold and dreary business. Men huddled together for warmth, stamping their feet and swinging leaden arms in their heavy duffel coats. Repeatedly they were turned out for action, which only too regularly proved a false alarm.
"Same old story," muttered one of the gun's crew. "Wish the perishing un would let us have a crack at him."
"You'll get your chance, matey, before this lot's over," the cook, who was the oldest member, retorted.
The loudspeaker on the bridge crackled again.
"Vessels identified. Am returning to my station."
"Fall out, action stations."
Peter sighed as he leaned over the bridge to give the order. This constant interruption of sleep made men irritable, but he was lucky in his ship's company. Not often was there serious grumbling. Once again the convoy settled down to its journey westwards, and trails of black smoke streamed from the jaunty funnels. Now the tide had turned, and the convoy was only making 4 knots. By 1 o'clock in the morning they still batted their way westwards, with Dungeness light barely abeam. The occulting light sent its pencil rays streaking across the horizon, but for 20 minutes only, while the convoy was in the vicinity. This was long enough, however, to betray it to the lurking enemy.
"It's too bright for E-boats anyway," Peter thought. "The western horizon's clear now, as bright as day. Reckon I can have a pipe in this visibility."
He turned to the lookouts.
"Carry on smoking."
"Thank you, sir."
Gnarled hands fumbled for hidden roll-me-owns, and eager lips dragged at dank tobacco which was lit from the smouldering slow match hanging by the chart table. Peter puffed contentedly at his favourite pipe and settled down on the hinged wooden seat fixed to the bridge side. One arm over the splinter mattresses which festooned the bridge, he swept the horizon with his binoculars.
"Nothing in sight. Might be a peacetime manoeuvre," he thought. "Royal Sovereign Lightship and Beachy Head next, and then we're nearly there."
It really was a lovely sight. On either bow stretched 2 straight lines of merchant ships, the largest of which was only about 2,000 tons. To seaward of them, small dots of MLs chugged onwards, dipping and curvetting in the long swell. The unseen moon, screened by a film of fleecy cloud, cast her light upon a sea that ran like quicksilver. Peter sighed contentedly.
"Wish all these convoys were like this," he thought, as he stretched his legs, which were stiff with the inaction and the cold, even though he was wearing his sheepskin boots.
A prolonged roar rumbled from ahead, reverberating across the stillness, and Peter's head jerked upwards as he glued the binoculars to his eyes. A dull glow flickered from somewhere ahead. Then, as he peered, a shattering explosion from the head of the starboard column split the brooding silence. Another followed in quick succession. In the port column, a huge spout of water leapt upwards.
"Mines! We've run into our own minefield!" Peter gasped.
Men had already appeared from below and were manning their guns, but before Peter could press the night alarm buzzer, a shock hit the hull of the little chaser as another ship blew up in the port column, only 0.5 mile distant. A searing orange flame drenched the sky as Peter focused his glasses on the spot, but there was nothing to be seen, nothing but a frothing, heaving mass of water.
"My God," he whispered, "how horrible."
There was nothing left, nothing.
"Stop both engines!"
Peter shouted down the voice pipe. The little ship lost way and glided gently to a stop. Peter dashed to the chart table and ran his eye over the thin pencil line that represented his ship's position.
"We're in the swept channel," he argued. "Strange."
The truth suddenly hit him. Athelstan had been hoodwinked. The ships which he had challenged had in fact been enemy mine-laying destroyers. They had laid their eggs ahead of the convoy and had streaked like sinister assassins back to France. Urgently, the loudspeaker crackled again.
"All ships, repeat, all ships, act independently and proceed via swept channel to Portsmouth. Enemy have laid mines. Chaser 25, recover survivors. Acknowledge."
"Pretty obvious," Peter snapped as he reached for the WT transmitter.
"Message received," he said.
The remaining ships of the convoy were already growing smaller as the distance widened, black smoke now pouring from their funnels as the convoy desperately forged ahead to clear the danger area. Then he noticed that the last ship in the starboard column had started to haul out of line to port.
"She's trying to pick up survivors," thought Peter.
He moved to the voice pipe.
"Full ahead, both."
The little ship tremored as she gathered way, and the pulse from her diesels pounded in the engine room so that the ship shook.
"This ought to trigger off any remaining mines," Peter thought anxiously. "I'm sitting on top of a minefield, and they may be acoustics. Not a pleasant thought, this, as diesel ships were the most vulnerable."
The chaser closed the obstinate collier, which was now 200 yards on her starboard beam, and Peter picked up the microphone of the loud hailer.
"Get back into position, please. Get back into station," he ordered.
"Bloomin' well get out of my way. I'm picking up survivors," a Geordie voice yelled back across the water.
Peter hesitated as he once more picked up the microphone, but as he did so, an explosion like the crack of doom rent the air, and a searing sheet of heat sent him reeling against the compass. His head spun as the shock struck the sides of the little chaser, so that she listed suddenly from the impact. A curtain of red and green flames leapt skywards, roaring into the night. Peter staggered and clutched the bridge side, as into his consciousness was indelibly stenciled a sight he would never forget. The bows of the collier had disappeared, and where they had once been, a seething mass of debris and foam boiled and hissed. The ship's funnel leaned drunkenly forward. Her stern was cocked out of the water, so that her propellers still threshed the air with slow beats, while the screams of dying men wailed through the night.
"Help me! For God's sake, save us!"
came a desperate cry across the water from a stricken man in the port column as he flailed the water.
"Hard a port! Full ahead together! Steer for that man in the water, coxswain!"
"Aye, aye, sir," the deep voice answered.
"Might as well save him, number one. This other ship's a goner," Peter yelled. "Stand by to pick him up, port side two."
As the chaser closed on the pathetic figure struggling in the water, the desperate cries of other drowning men drifted across the waters from all sides.
"Stop both! Stand by to recover!"
But as the chaser went full astern to halt alongside the dark head bobbing in the oily sea, the man disappeared, with only a ripple marking his grave. Sickened, Peter turned away.
"Two men, starboard beam, sir!"
yelled the starboard lookout, pointing with outstretched arm.
"Harder starboard, slow ahead together!"
And the chaser slid alongside another group of struggling men.
"Catch this line and come alongside the scrambling net!" yelled a voice on the forecastle.
A heaving line snaked through the air to plop across the struggling men, who grabbed it, gasping and spluttering. Gently, slowly, they were pulled alongside, and strong hands snatched them from the hungry waters.
"Look at that, sir!"
the starboard lookout yelled. Peter's head jerked. The stern of the doomed ship was barely 100 yards away, hanging poised between sky and water, and looming some 50 feet in the air. She was settling fast, ready for her final plunge. From the port quarter of the looming transom, a man hung head downwards, caught by his feet in the bite of a rope. He was swinging to and fro with the slow motion of the swell, and trying frantically to clutch the rope and heave himself upwards to get back to the slanting deck. His body jerked like a marionette on a string. A terrifying silence gripped the scene as men watched the pitiful struggles of the doomed man. Gasping sobs floated across the diminishing space of water that separated the two wallowing ships.
"I can't let this happen, even if she takes us with her," Peter whispered as he leapt for the voice pipe.
"Slow ahead, port! Harder starboard!"
The chaser slid in under the counter of the towering transom. The dark mass hung above the little ship's forecastle, blacking out the sky. Slowly, foot by foot, the chaser's bow edged nearer. Peter crouched low over the voice pipe, conning her with every ounce of skill and concentration he possessed.
"Midships, slow astern together!"
So close were they that he could hear the swishing gurgle of water as it lapped along the stern of the merchant ship, and he could plainly see the rusty rudder jammed to port. The black mass hung and plunged in the swell, 15-10 feet above the chaser's bows.
"She's going, sir!"
yelled a voice from the forecastle.
"Grab him! Go on, grab him! Cut the rope!" Peter shouted.
He could bear to look no longer, but waited for the rending crash as the ship plunged down upon them. Frantic hands grappled for the dangling body. Stretching over the guardrails, they clutched and reached again.
"Knife! No! Cut! Cut!"
was all Peter could hear from his helpless position on the bridge. A dull gleam glimmered on the forecastle.
"Astern! Go astern, sir!"
screamed a man from the forecastle. Peter glanced over the bridge. A crumpled figure sprawled across the guardrails.
"Full astern together!"
Peter yelled down the voicepipe. His knuckles showed white in the pale moonlight. The engines coughed into life. The huge mass plunged and slid downwards, towards the chaser's forecastle. The chaser quivered as she gathered sternway. Faster, faster, she glided and pulled away. Metal screeched as it tore apart, but as suddenly the sickening sound ceased. The little ship shook herself and leapt astern as she came free, like a cork from a bottle.
"Stop both!"
The chaser lost way as her company watched the death throes of the collier. Already nothing but the counter remained. For a moment it hung there, her red duster hanging limp but proud in the still night. Then, with a rush, she went. The water boiled for an instant, debris shooting to the surface, and she was gone. The port lookout, a young seaman of 18, was vomiting over the side. It was all Peter could do not to keep him company, but mercifully more urgent problems demanded his immediate concentration. Apart from the pathetic flotsam which marked the watery resting place of these brave ships, the silver ocean stretched before him. They were now alone, dependent upon themselves. They drifted upon the surface of the treacherous minefield, and there would be little hope for them if they touched off a mine now. Peter checked his doubtful position on the chart.
"Slow ahead together," he ordered.
The chaser gingerly slid over the placid sea for another 5 miles. Not until Beachy Head was abeam to starboard, gleaming and white in the moonlight, did Peter relax and send the men below. Somehow, when floating on top of a gunpowder keg, it felt better to stay up on deck, because the cramped quarters of a mess deck were depressing and coffin-like. It was now 4 o'clock in the morning, and already the first steely light of dawn streaked the eastern horizon.
"Fallout action stations. Go to cruising stations, number one."
"Aye, aye, sir. Orders for the morning."
Peter shook his sleep-hungry head and suppressed a yawn.
"ETA Portsmouth 0730, number one. We'll have breakfast off the Nab Tower, weather and Huns permitting. Good night, number one, or rather good morning."
Jamie turned for the bridge ladder.
"And number one?"
"Yes, sir."
"I would like to see the man we took off. I'll see him later on."
"Yes, sir."
"And number one?"
"Yes, sir."
"Thank you, and well done."
"Good night, sir."
"Good morning."
The Nab Tower jutted like a beckoning finger from the sea off Culver Cliff. The chaser curved round and chugged up to Portsmouth Harbour. In the entrance, she turned hard a port and glided up Hasler Creek, past the empty submarine base.
"Thank heaven I don't serve in those things," Peter joked to his first lieutenant.
Jamie was staring through his glasses.
"The ambulance is waiting, sir."
On the jetty at the end of the creek, the red-crossed ambulance stood waiting for its usual guests. The chaser came neatly alongside, and the injured men were gently put ashore in stretchers. Peter looked down from the bridge. On the forecastle, his weary men waited to shove off.
"Cast off, forward!"
10 minutes later, the little ship moored inside the basin of the submarine base, the chaser's operational headquarters. As Peter reached the upper deck, he met his first lieutenant, who was looking extraordinarily embarrassed.
"Well, what is it, number one? I'm going below to get my head down," snapped Peter irritably, as waves of tiredness flowed over him.
He was untoggling his duffel coat and peeling off his clothes, and could not reach his bunk quickly enough.
"I'm afraid I've made a frightful bog of it, sir. We have still got the man you took off on board," Jamie added nervously. "He requests to see you."
"Confound it, number one. He should have gone ashore with the others. There's nothing the matter with him."
"That's the point, sir. He wants to stay with us."
"For crying out loud, number one, it's time you woke up. I can't possibly see him. Send him ashore."
"Aye, aye, sir. Sorry, sir."
"All right." Peter started forward for his cabin hatch. He paused, scratching his head.
"I've never refused to see a man yet," he murmured to himself.
He took a pace backwards.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?